Back on the Jefferson Exchange on JPR, I'm Jeffrey Riley. We'll take up food as our next topic, but not in a cookbook and recipe sense. We'll get into some of the basic issues of where our food comes from and what it takes to produce it. The current meat-heavy diets on Earth require lots of resources, to say nothing of the sacrifice of the animals we eat. Our next guest is a vegan and examines veganism and a wider view of food systems in a new book. Nina Guilbeault wrote The Good Eater, A Vegan Search for the Future of Food. You can call Nina Guilbeault a sociologist, author, and educator. Nina holds a PhD in sociology and a certificate of plant-based nutrition. Nina also co-founded Plant Futures, a nonprofit associated with the School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley. Nina Guilbeault, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored.
It's good to have you. You start the book by talking about something of a vegan boom in the last 10 years. Was it a long time coming?
You know, this movement, which I didn't know before I studied it, is actually quite ancient. It comes to us first from Pythagoras and many other luminaries throughout history. And so this philosophy, this way of living, has been around for a long time. And, you know, we can trace it to ancient times, but really it's in the 1970s that it becomes the animal rights movement. And then today, in the last 5 to 10 years, what I would say is veganism has become a lifestyle movement. So, you know, we see this interest in what we would call plant-based eating today, the rise of plant-based products, the interest, you know, of kind of these alternative products coming out of Silicon Valley and so on. So I was really interested in understanding how veganism transformed culturally from a fringe kind of lifestyle diet into more of a mainstream movement.
It is a bit more of that when you make the case for it there, certainly. And when you think about the things you can see in the grocery store now, the vegan label is applied in ways it didn't used to be.
That's right. We see it on so many different products. And I think there's just an overall consciousness around the fact that, as you mentioned, plant-based diets really have an incredible impact on our planet. So that's, I think, the thing that most people are aware of today. But also, of course, there's more consciousness around how animals are raised on factory farms. And, you know, I was really interested in how did this movement that was quite fringe, and honestly, if someone had told me that I would become vegan, I would have never guessed it. I grew up in an Eastern European family. I'm a Francophile. I really love France. I've spent a lot of time in France. And, you know, if someone had told me I would give up cheese and meat and eggs sometime in my life, I would have never believed them. But there was this movement that really interested me because at the time that I started just kind of hearing about it, I was a graduate student at Harvard, and I was looking for a dissertation topic. And at the same time, my grandfather, with whom I had grown up and to whom I was very close, passed away quite prematurely from chronic disease, from cancer and diabetes. And that really inspired me to look at the link between diet and disease. And what I discovered really, really shocked me to my core. I discovered that we had actually known for a long time about the nutritional benefits of plant-based diets and the fact that plant-based diets are the only diets that can really not only prevent, but actually reverse chronic disease. And that really made me question the choices that my family had made around food and just we as a society. And then also looking at the environmental impact, the outside impact of meat, dairy, and eggs on climate. And of course, the ethical issue, not just around animals and how they're raised in factory farms, industrial agriculture, but also the human question, the slaughterhouse workers, and even the farm workers. So veganism really is not, I think, the end of a series of questions around how to eat, but really is the beginning of a journey. So in this book, I really try to take readers on a journey to really question what are their own values around food and what kind of choices do they want to make that are in alignment with those values.
The story about your response to your grandfather's illness and death is quite moving, but you also remind us about some other things around that the rest of us were aware of in the world, like the evidence of cancer potential from processed meats. And the world kind of got past that one in a hurry, didn't it?
It did. I mean, the Worldwide Health Network, basically, the worldwide, you know, okay, health industry really kind of mentioned processed meat as carcinogenic. And actually, they showed that there is a link that's as strong as, you know, asbestos or other causes of cancer that are basically well known. So it is a correlation, but it's a very strong correlation. And, you know, it's not just processed meat, although that's what they mentioned. It's also kind of actually there's evidence for all animal protein having negative impacts and potentially even cancerous impacts. And really, this has not been shown for a plant-based diet. And so, of course, meat, dairy, eggs, they have certain essential nutrients, but those nutrients you can also get from a plant-based diet. And so when that was cited worldwide, it made a lot of headlines at the time, but then quickly people really didn't want to look more into it.
Nina Gilbo is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of The Good Eater, A Vegan Search for the Future of Food. You tell us about going down quite a rabbit hole in research, and I get the sense of you finding things out about things you had loved to eat and going, oh man, I can't eat that now either.
Absolutely. And actually at the time I was doing research in France, and I remember, you know, eating all the gelato and pastries and all these things and really not thinking twice about them. And I actually think, you know, ignorance can be blissful to some extent because we almost don't want to know about these things. And, there's actually a term for this in psychology. It's called the meat paradox. It's this idea that we actually know a lot of the dark truth around how our food is produced, but we want to turn a blind eye toward that. There's also cognitive dissonance at play, this idea that we actually want to actively turn away from things that are, things that are uncomfortable truths, essentially. And there are also a lot of cultural factors that maintain eating of meat, dairy, and eggs, because, you know, it's a big part of our culture. You think about, you know, turkey at Thanksgiving or many other cultures, meat actually holds a very high status because historically meat was actually rare. So one thing I really try to say in the book is this is actually not new. What I'm advocating for is return to how we used to eat, you know, 50 to 70 years ago, which is that plants, whole grains, fruits, vegetables, legumes, these were the cornerstone of our diets. And, the central foodstuffs that have really, fed us, humanity, and fed many different cultural and culinary generations. And I'm advocating for a return toward that, because now what we're doing is we're having these products three times a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And that's just simply not sustainable from an environmental standpoint, and it's not good for our health. It is definitely not good for animals, who I think used to be seen still as, beings with moral regard, but now I think they're often viewed as commodities. So I am personally vegan. I'm philosophically vegan. I believe in a philosophy, but I do think that, the onus is on all of us to really question how we want to eat. And I think that, if we decide we want to eat animal products, I think we really have to question, how are they produced? Where are they made? How often are we eating them? So I'm really advocating for a really vast reduction in animal products and really trying to, fill our plate with the abundance of the plant kingdom.
Come back to the environmental standpoint you mentioned a moment ago, though, because this has some very large implications. And I was trying to nail down the actual figures. There seems to be some variety. The figure gets quoted often that it takes 1,800 gallons of water to produce a pound of beef. But I saw some other figures out there, too. The fact is, it just takes a lot of resources to keep us in meat.
That's right. It's so many resources. I mean, water is one of the biggest. Often, people say, almonds, they take up a lot of water. But actually, if you look at almonds versus dairy, there's no comparison. Like, dairy has a huge adverse impact. Meat, especially beef from cattle, and it's just the greenhouse gas emissions are enormous. And that's actually the case also for grass-fed beef, which has often been cited as, alternative to feedlot beef. If we produce grass-fed beef at the level that we're currently producing feedlot beef, we just simply don't have enough land. So it's water, it's carbon emissions, it is land use. And so the impact is really, really, really profound. And I think most people actually are not really aware at the scale. And somewhere between 15 to 30% of greenhouse gas emissions can be attributed to, animal products produced on factory farms.
Nina Gilbo is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of The Good Eater, A Vegan's Search for the Future of Food. I never stopped to think about the birth of veganism by that term. Who was Donald Watson?
Donald Watson was an Englishman. He was a woodworker, and he grew up in a mining community. And, he really wasn't a likely vegan, but sometime in his kind of early 20s, he joined the Vegetarian Society, which already existed in England at the time. And, originally the term vegetarian actually referred to an entirely plant-based diet, meaning no animal products at all. And prior to that, it was actually known as a Pythagorean diet because historically when people would eat a plant-based diet, it was referred to as a Pythagorean diet because it was Pythagoras who is probably one of the earliest proponents in the West of a plant-based diet. And Donald Watson essentially became quite concerned about the fact that dairy and eggs started being considered vegetarian, even though originally vegetarian actually meant what we know of today as vegan. And he was looking for another term, and he was considering many different options. One of them was bon mangeur, which in French, if we translate it, is the good eater. So my book title is inspired in part by that coining. But in the end, he landed on the start and end of vegetarian, which his wife Dorothy coined. And so vegan is what we refer to it today. And veganism really refers to a philosophy, a way of living that attempts to reduce as much as possible the harm done to animals. So not just food and diet, but also, using animals in circuses or rodeos or entertainment, but also, leather and so on. And then a plant-based diet is a little bit of a fuzzy term, but typically it refers to a diet that doesn't have any animal products in it.
So in addition to Donald Watson, some other names crop up in this part of the book, including some we don't expect. For example, what did Leo Tolstoy add to the efforts to avoid eating animals?
Well, Leo Tolstoy, of course, is known for War and Peace, Anna Karenina. He's one of my favorite authors, actually. But in the second half of his life, he had a spiritual awakening, and he began to write quite feverishly about progressive causes, including educating serfs, pacifism, and also the renunciation of hunting, alcohol, and meat. I will say that he was more of an idealist than someone who was pragmatic. So a lot of the time he had these beliefs but struggled to actually implement them in his life. And yet he wrote quite, I would say, graphically about what happens to animals when they're slaughtered and in what at the time were slaughterhouses. And now, of course, it's done on a much larger scale. And Leo Tolstoy also, many people don't know this, but he inspired Mahatma Gandhi, actually, who had grown up vegetarian, but then essentially had renounced it when he went to England for a while. And then there he found Tolstoy's writings and his notion of nonviolence, which, of course, in Eastern philosophy is known as ahimsa, with which Gandhi had grown up in his culture, that really inspired his part of his ethic around nonviolence. So there's a direct link, actually, between Tolstoy and Gandhi, which is something that is not well known.
Yeah, that was really interesting. And, of course, a lot of people followed in Tolstoy's footsteps in working to publicize the horrible things that animals endure in becoming our food. And I get the sense that you think some of them might have gone a bit far in publicizing awful things that happen in factory farms and labs.
Well, I mean, what happened actually is that until the 1970s, the writings of Tolstoy and others, I think, was still quite on the fringe. I think what happened in the 1970s with the counterculture is the rise of what we today know as the animal rights movement. And, I think some would think that they've gone too far. I mean, I don't really have, a personal sense that they've gone too far, but I would say that they definitely left a kind of bad taste, literally and figuratively, in the culture, because I think there were some tactics that were more extreme. And I mean, there's no doubt that animal rights activists have done an enormous amount for publicizing, the conditions on factory farms. I think a lot of us wouldn't necessarily know about those conditions without those activists. But I think that sometimes their tactics really targeted people through kind of moral outcry and really kind of in-your-face activism. So there was a lot of, like tactics such as throwing red paint on fur coats. So there were kind of like sensationalist tactics. That's not true for everyone in the movement, but there were, a lot of folks who were doing things like that. And I think just that we've learned in the last 50 years that activism is really important throughout history. There's always been those who have, advocated in the more kind of extreme or in-your-face way. And actually, those are really important because the radical flank, as it's often called in sociology, actually does push culture. And we can think about, the feminist movement or civil rights movement. I think those activists are really important, actually. But I think what we've learned over time is that the vast majority of people, the early adopters might be influenced by that, but the later adopters, those in the mainstream and the majority, aren't necessarily swayed by that. And so in general, also our behavioral change doesn't always come from, kind of these moral outcry and these kind of in-your-face tactics, often people are more swayed by the feeling of abundance, something that they can gain from a movement. And so I think veganism has started shifting in that direction. You know, when I first became vegan, I had my what I would call the angry vegan phase, where I really wanted to convert everyone, and I really felt this was the right way to be. I think over time, I've just learned that isn't that effective. What's more effective is cooking a delicious meal for people and inviting them over and showing them the benefit of this lifestyle and really being an example of bringing people into the tent and actually expanding the tent and not necessarily being a morally kind of purist vegan either, because I think that it's far more important that many of us vastly reduce meat consumption than it is for a small number of people to be vegan.
We'll come back and pick up the conversation with Nina Gilbo, the author of The Good Eater, back on the Jefferson Exchange in just a bit. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Nina Gilbo is with us, a sociologist, author, and educator, and vegan, looking at the world through a vegan lens, but not just for herself, but for all of us, and to look at the ways that we might consider changing our food system. Nina Gilbo's book is The Good Eater, A Vegan's Search for the Future of Food. We were just talking about the efforts of people in the animal rights movement to publicize things and how they got vegans into the headlines. And then some individual stories here. Introduce us, if you would, to Bruce Friedrich and how he changed his approach.
Absolutely. So Bruce Friedrich is actually a fascinating person, someone who I had met actually quite early on in my research for my dissertation, which is really was the basis of this book. And he's someone who started off actually as a PETA campaigner. He was someone who was hanging Meat is Murder posters in his Baltimore classroom when he was doing Teach for America. And he's somebody who was behind many of the campaigns that we know of from PETA that were targeting fast food companies. And, you know, Bruce told me that essentially he had really believed that, you know, if he just handed out enough leaflets, or if he just enough light bulbs came on in his classroom, that he could really shift the world to understand that there's no difference between a human and a non-human animal. And he really comes from it from his Christian faith, which really inspired all of his activism. He was actually originally inspired by the book Diet for a Small Planet, where he realized that the amount of resources that were going into the production of meat, dairy, and eggs were so outsized compared to the calories that they produced, that he just felt like this was food waste, essentially, which it is. And but, you know, his tactics, essentially, over time, he found that they weren't really working. The veganism still stayed quite small. It was still 1-3% of the population, which it continues to be today, actually. So there's a lot more of a movement toward reducing meat and flexitarianism and so on. But still, the people who identify as vegan are still quite small. I mean, it's definitely growing among younger generations. But that movement is also coinciding with the rise of meat consumption. And so Bruce Friedrich looked at these numbers and essentially was quite despondent about the fact that they weren't rising. And at the time, there was a shift from veganism as something that's promoted as a kind of behavioral and lifestyle choice toward more of a consumption practice. And there was this interest from Silicon Valley and other other kind of interested investors who wanted to birth this new kind of approach, which, proponents would call alternative protein and detractors would call fake meat. But it's this movement toward actually creating better and more realistic meat, dairy, and egg replacements than the ones that existed in the 1970s, the legacy brands. So we can think of companies like Beyond Meat or Impossible Foods or Miyoko's Creamery, for example. And so these companies were rising, and Bruce became very passionate about them because he essentially felt like, you know, if we match the convenience of these foods and we match the price, if we match the taste, then consumers are more likely to switch. And they'll do so not because they're necessarily vegan, but because they're able to have this alternative, which is healthier and more sustainable and so on. And so he became the director of the Good Food Institute, which is a nonprofit that promotes this industry. And it was really interesting to talk to him because I think his internal shift really represented this paradigmatic shift in general in this movement, from one that was really trying to change hearts and minds to one that was really just trying to create new products. And I talk about some of the benefits of this shift toward kind of plant-based industry and so on. But I also talk about some of the challenges, which is, you know, that some of these products are undeniably processed food and I think don't fully deserve the health halo that surrounds them. But at the same time, I think they touch on many of the environmental and the health issues in this movement.
Well, it is interesting. What you're talking about then is the decision to go ahead and try to change behaviors instead of minds, which is ultimately easier. It's kind of the fake it till you make it theory in a sense. And then to the individual examples you give here, you take us into Beyond Meat and get us to meet Ethan Brown. Talk about the analysis that led to the products at Beyond Meat.
Well, it was fascinating, actually, because I got to visit the headquarters of Beyond Meat back in 2018, which is before the company went public and before it was, you know, huge company. At the time, it was still relatively small. It was a startup, and I got to visit it in Los Angeles. And I met Ethan Brown, who doesn't look at all like a vegan CEO of a meat company. He's, you know, somebody who looks more like a football player. So it's really not the kind of vegan that we used to imagine. I think, you know, the stereotype of what a vegan looks like, I think, used to be much more like a hippie type person. And there was Ethan Brown really embodying this very new and different image of veganism. And the, you know, the idea behind Beyond Meat was really, can we make meat from plants? That was really Ethan Brown's idea. He was a vegan himself, but he still really missed meat. And so he was wondering, is there a way to do this? And so essentially their idea was to take plant-based products. So in their case, it was peas. And basically through the magic of food science, which included extracting protein from these peas, combining it with fats, with coconut oil and so on, combining it with, in their case, natural dyes from beet and I think pomegranate as well. At some point they were exploring to create a realistic meat-like substance that really looks, tastes, and even cooks like meat. They actually, their patties were kind of reddish and then they would turn brown when they sizzled on the pan. And this was an innovation at the time. I think right now they're getting quite a lot of pushback because, again, there's this pushback against plant-based still being quite processed, a lot of these products. I mean, I would put these products in the category of transition foods. I think they're really great if people really miss meat and they want to move toward a more sustainable and ultimately healthier product. But personally, I still try to eat kind of whole plants, you know, real foods like whole grains, fruits, vegetables, and legumes. And I would hope that more people would be interested in actually experimenting with our culinary histories and all of the abundance of the plant kingdom. But I do think there's a role for these products. I mean, I refer to them in the book as absurd solutions to absurd problems, because it's a little bit absurd to extract protein from peas, to try to mix it with coconut, to, you know, make it seem like cow's meat. I mean, that's pretty strange if you think about it. At the same time, the hamburgers they're trying to replace are full of, you know, antibiotics. They're full of pesticides from the monoculture fields of soy and corn that are fed to farm animals. They're full of many kind of toxic compounds. And so, you know, we think of meat as just being quote unquote one ingredient, but it really isn't. We actually look at the food chain that leads to the production of a meat hamburger. So I do hear the sort of the criticism of plant-based products as being kind of just another example of the processed food playbook. And I, you know, I do unpack that in the book. I think that there's some truth to that claim, and I do really want people to eat more real food. At the same time, I want them to consider what this is replacing and that product itself. The hamburger that many of us were having, you know, on Memorial Day is really, really problematic.
Nina Gilboa is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Good Eater, A Vegan's Search for the Future of Food. I want to come back to one point about some of these meat replacement products. You mentioned coconut oil, and I just wonder about what kinds of trade-offs you get. I mean, if you may end up having fewer cows consumed, but then do you end up having larger coconut oil plantations to feed the process of making these fake burgers?
That's right. I mean, all of these products are made from plant-based components that have their own, you know, environmental and ethical issues. And that's why, again, I think these products are the start rather than the end of a conversation around how to eat. And if I would have it all my way, they wouldn't necessarily be a big part of our future food. They would, you know, serve as replacements for the time being. But, you know, as you say, it's also all about scale. I mean, it's true that this coconut oil is not necessarily much better for us or grown sustainably, but honestly, if we compare it to the monoculture fields of corn and soy, and just the sheer scale of how much land we're using to feed farm animals, again, I would say that it's a better, if not perfect, solution. And that's why I think focusing on real foods, foods grown regeneratively, organically, and as much as possible in local food systems rather than these large conglomerate food systems, I think is really important. But again, in terms of scale, it's pretty comparable. Plant-based products, the impact that they have on land use, water use, and so on, it's so much less than the current system that we have to say that they're better, but they're not a perfect solution.
You mentioned some of the trade-offs involved elsewhere. If, for example, we decided, okay, let's make all our beef grass-fed, and you mentioned already it would take a considerable increase in acreage, but let's talk about it in the other direction. If we all became vegan, what would happen to agricultural land, Nina?
Well, we'd actually have a lot more of it. I have, you know, a great friend, Matthew Hayek, who's a professor at NYU, and he has really compelling research that shows that if we actually all transitioned to a more plant-based diet, we would have far more land, and we'd actually be able to use that land to feed people. I mean, currently the land we use for the most part is to grow corn and soy, those fed to farmed animals, so we don't actually have that much land to spare, that much water to spare. And if we were to move toward eating, you know, more plant-based, that would actually give us a lot more resources, and we would have choices about how to feed our growing world population. And grass-fed is an alternative that has been advocated by many. I actually talk about in the book how grass-fed is only a solution if it's also combined with fast meat reduction. We simply don't have enough land and resources to grow grass-fed beef and all continue eating as much meat as we do. So that's only possible if we really reduce meat consumption. And in that sense, I think the grass-fed movement and the vegan movement are actually quite aligned in terms of seeing factory farming as the common enemy. But there's no doubt that if we've all moved to a worldwide vegan diet, there would be a lot more opportunities to actually build a better food system.
Well, it seems then that we certainly have many more options than I think we used to think of for ourselves, certainly a few decades ago, when everything, meat and potatoes in Western culture, certainly. We've switched away from that quite a bit. But do you see a clear direction taking shape, or are there any one of a number of different avenues you think the whole worldwide food system could go?
Well, I mean, there are just certainly environmental limits to the growth of the standard American diet around the world, even though globally, when countries tend to develop, they adopt that diet. And so there is the shift toward actually eating more meat. That is a trend that is rising at the same time that there's this interest in plant-based. So they're actually concurrent trends. But there are certain limits. There are simply environmental limits, and we've already passed the 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold. And so what I hope for the future of food is that there are more good eaters. And by that, I just mean eaters who are more conscious about the choices that they're making and the impact of the food that is on their plate, the food chain that is leading to the food that is on their plate. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, I am hoping that some of this change toward shifting to our plant-based diets actually happens organically, because as a society, we decide that we want our food system to prioritize values like diversity and regeneration and health and well-being rather than profit and essentially having externalized costs in the form of environmental damage and health disparities, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's what I'm hoping will happen. But unfortunately, I think, as a sociologist, I know that behavioral change is very hard to promote. And so I'm looking toward the younger generation. I think Gen Zs are far more conscious about the environmental impact, at least, of their food. And I'm hoping that there is a generational shift toward plant-based diets.
We will see. I imagine there's probably, you probably could have made a book twice this size because the research team's quite thorough in here, and there's just a whole lot in here to take in and digest, in a sense. Yeah, the book is called The Good Eater, A Vegan Search for the Future of Food. It's by Nina Gilboa, who is a sociologist, author, and educator. Nina, thanks so much for writing the book, and thanks for sharing it with us here on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And that's it for today's Exchange. We're always on the web at jeffexchange.org with all of our interviews archived there and live streaming to boot. Angela Decker of JPR News is our senior producer. Mike Green hosts Common Ground Conversations. Charlie Zimmerman is our assistant producer. Our broadcast engineers are Zach Beagle and Andrew Crackle. Our theme music is composed by Maxwell and Terry Longshore. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe and cool, and have a great day.